We did it. I still can't believe we got this project done so fast and so well.
When I'm in New York,
I'm in Chicago,
and I'm in LA. But
we're making it happen in Miro.
Together.
Our best work just happens faster on Miro's collaborative online whiteboard. No more scheduling meeting after meeting for work that could happen
from anywhere, whether it's getting design feedback here,
mapping timelines here,
or brainstorming next steps here. It all just happens on the Miro board.
Exactly. And it's nice not having to wait an entire day to get sign-off from this guy.
Hey! Well, it is true.
See how Miro users save up to 80 hours every year by meeting less and doing more. Get on board at Miro.com. The first three boards are free forever. That's Miro.com.
Hello and welcome to the Boys in a Band podcast. I'm Richie Gallagher.
And I'm Peter Smith, and the podcast back for another series. And we've got a great one lined up for you today, guys. We're joined by Nick Hodgson, who is a founding member of Kaiser Chiefs. He was their drummer right up to the end of 2012. He was also behind a lot of their songwriting for their biggest hits. And it was great to get his insight into how this music came together for one of the era's most distinctive and successful bands.
Yeah, absolutely. Nick tells us about that magic piano, as he calls it, which he wrote some of their biggest tunes on. And he was there right from the start when members of the band met at school. They formed a band called Runciton Parva. They actually landed a record deal in one of those early incarnations. But Nick kicks off the pod by giving us a detailed breakdown of that time and how that initial deal they got actually gave them a bit of trouble getting signed as Kaiser Chiefs. The record companies were all wishing they had signed them a short while after when the likes of I Predict the Riot came out. That one in particular just became a huge anthem of the noughties scene. And Nick tells us here why he thinks it was so successful.
I just think there's a load of technical things, like in terms of structure and all. I think it's brilliant. But I shouldn't say that. I don't mind saying that it's our best song. And I don't know, I'm philosophical about this. I love the fact that it connected and it was great. And I still hear it and still people say, oh, I heard it last night in a bar or whatever. I always say, what did they think? What were people thinking? Are they singing? What are they doing? Were they dancing? Right.
Yeah, there are other bands that can point to songs they've released that blew up, like I Predict a Riot, but Kaiser Chiefs were a rarity, really, in that they had others like Oh My God, and especially Ruby off the second album, which were also heard everywhere at that time. There's an interesting story, actually, wasn't there, from the NME Awards, where they played Ruby, and I think Nick spotted some sniggering from the Arctic Monkeys in the front row. But, you know, there's a bit of inter-band rivalry at those events, and it was quite interesting to hear his thoughts on those shows.
Yeah, it was. I think in the early days, it was a bit of a badge of honour that they were trying to prove everybody wrong, but it didn't really concern them too much once they were out there living it up and having number one hit singles, and why would it, given that sort of success? But 4 years after that first gig, they played to 40 people. They were playing to 40,000 at Elland Road. They played huge gigs around the world, including the closing ceremony at the 2012 London Olympics, which is quite timely given the Olympics right now. And Nick lifts the lid on what it was like being in that band as it blew up massively.
Yeah, as we said, he stepped away from the band at the end of 2012. But he's been busy since, writing songs and producing songs for a wide range of artists. So we find out a bit more about that career switch too. But mostly, it's just a fascinating chat full of detail from Nick about being in one of Britain's biggest bands. So here he is, Nick Hodgson, previously of the Kaiser Chiefs, on the Boys in the Band podcast.
This week on the Boys in the Band podcast, we're delighted to be joined by Nick Hodgson from Kaiser Chiefs. How's it going, Nick?
It's going good. Yeah, yep. I'm all ready. Happy.
Excellent.
Good to go.
Well, let's get warmed up with the sound check. It's three quick fire questions to start off with, Nick. And the first one is always, whereabouts are you?
I'm in studio in my house in London, North London.
Very nice. And yeah, we can see all the gear. You've got a very professional setup. Very nice. We always do the second question in the sound check, Nick, is what you're listening to at the moment. So are there any artists that you're particularly fond of right now?
I can never remember that. The question is a funny one because I listen to so much stuff that's like just a lot of new stuff and little bits and pieces of stuff. And I never go, oh yeah, I've been listening to this, but I listen to new stuff. So I've just been recording with this band called Priestgate. So I've been listening to them nonstop. And I found a band called Mount Misery, actually, who are really good. I like them, from Hartlepool. And then I just listen to like New Music Friday just to check it all out.
Yeah.
I skip a lot of stuff on that. And I just want to know what's going on. So I just listen to everything new.
Cool. Yeah, New Music Friday, very handy. Final question, Nick. Tell us about this podcast. Rich mentioned the sort of microphone setup you got there and everything. Do you know how many bands there are? So what got you into this and exploring life in bands with other band people from bands?
Yeah, well, let's think. It was January this year, and I thought, I just wanted to do a podcast. I think I'd watched this documentary about the Comedy Store in LA, and a lot of people, including Joe Rogan, had gone into podcasts. And that just, and obviously you're in lockdown. There wasn't much going on. And I thought, I can do that. What's my specialist subject? And I went, it's not just bands. It's kind of like, well, it is bands really, but it's all about the real internal stuff about bands, what it feels like in a band, what your relationships with other band members are, and all those little details. Like, I always ask, like, can you remember the first time you walked on stage and all your gear was set up? Because I think these are kind of the questions that I'm interested in, those little tiny details. If someone says about their day or something, I say, what time do you get up? And like, what did you have for breakfast? I don't know why, but I just like that minutiae of the tiny things in bands. Like, where did you sit in the van?
Yeah, the important details. So, Nick, we're looking forward to hearing all about Kaiser Chief's story and what you've been doing since. So let's go right back to the start and tell us how the band came together. I understand there are a couple of early incarnations of the band and then sort of reformed into what we know as Kaiser Chiefs. So, how did it all start out?
Started out in Leeds. Well, I think it really started out. Me and Simon, who's the bass player, we always, like when we were 11, we met, we were in the same class and we played music together. I'd go to his house and in his loft he had a drum kit and I'd play the drums and he would play, I can't remember what he played, guitar. And we just played songs. We played Wishing Well by Thin Lizzy, is it? Oh, no, it's Free. We played another song by Thin Lizzy, Wishing Well by Free. I don't know why, just because that maybe we had the chords for that song, which is weird. I didn't even know it. And his dad would help us. His dad would sort of tune our guitars and stuff. And we were always in bands, whether they actually got together and played any songs. Sometimes you were in a band, but you were just, it was a band on paper, really, just like when you're writing in your exercise book the name of the band and the logo and doing all that. And Peanut was in our class as well, but we didn't really hang out with him that much at first. And then he got into the guitar when we were about 15, and then we just joined up together. So it was me, Peanut, and Simon. Friend called Adam on singing. I mean, I'm going seriously back. This is right down into the weeds here. Are you interested in this level of detail? I'll spin it on a bit. So we had a few lead singers, a few members, and then let me think. And then I met Ricky through a friend. He went to the same school as my friend. And he was in bands, and so he was always like the lead singer and a real kind of flamboyant character, even like when he was 16, 17. And they used to have like band nights and stuff. And I sort of decided that he was going to be, because my friend Danny was always like, you should get Ricky to be the singer. And I was like, okay, whatever. And then I met him and I got him to be the singer. Don't know how. I just told him, you're going to be in my band now. And then and then we kind of were, which is weird. And then Whitey, the guitarist, I met. Actually, at this point, we changed because Simon and Peanut had gone off to university. So we were just in Leeds. There was me, Ricky and Whitey at that point, and two other guys, Jim and Mike. And we were called Runston Parva. So we had our first ever Runston Parva rehearsal in 1997, January. I had a picture of Runciton Palmer. I found it, and it should be here, but anyway. I'm sure it was here before. 97, we did our first gig. We were quite popular because we were quite entertaining, really. Ricky was great, and we had lots of mates in Leeds. Indie scene in Leeds was great. Loads of venues, loads of club nights. We got a Brighton Beach and Move On Up. Mod stuff, we were dead into mod. And we were kind of like a sort of, what were we like? Kind of like, we wanted to be heavier than Britpop, because Britpop, in our heads, Britpop was finished in 95. It didn't even cross into 96. And so we were very purist. We wanted to be like a bit more proggy, actually, but still kind of, I don't know, pop, 3.5 minute songs, 3 minute songs. That was Runciton Palmer. Oh, yeah. And then a couple of guys left. Then we were Palmer. Is this serious? I mean, I am going, I could go deeper than this, but.
This is good detail.
Right. And then we were Palmer. And then we got a record deal. That's when Simon and Peanut came back from university, joined the band again. We had some gigs, got signed, actually, which was amazing. In 2001, got dropped in 2002, made an album, didn't come out. And that really drove us on. We wanted to become, it was the same lineup. And we'd had a taste of how good it was being on tour and being on the road and just doing gigs every night. And it was mad. Like, what a crazy thing to do. Just go out and just go to a different town every day and play in front of, well, literally, sometimes literally two people. But we loved it. So we needed to continue. And then we really had to think hard because we couldn't get signed again. Because once you've been signed, it's difficult to get signed again because you've been... You've had an attempt and everyone's like, well, that didn't work. So why would it work again? So we scrapped all our songs. It's 2003 now. Scrapped all our songs, changed our clothes. Peanut put a hat on. Peanut went to keyboards as well, more significantly. And we decided we were going to be much more of a British sound because we were sort of chasing the whole garage rock sort of thing before. We're going to be, and our whole aim was to be the opposite of everything that was popular. And that was, we thought, if we were the absolute opposite, because I always had this phrase, if you can see the bandwagon, you've already missed it. And the bandwagon was absolutely in full effect at that point. NME could not write about a British band. It was all American bands and, you know, Australian, the Hives, the Vines, or the Strokes, and all those bands. There was 10 million bands like that. And they were just popping up every week and they were just getting worse and worse, but they were still getting into the NME. And we were like, okay, we need to be on the wave of the next, the forefront of what's coming next and what's going to come next. The opposite. That's what always happens. So we just wrote these, at the time we thought they were really quirky and weird, like Oh My God was weird. And we were a few, and Saturday Night was weird and Born to Be a Dancer was weird. And that was our first demo. We still got turned down a lot from that demo because it was different. But then we got NME Single of the Week with Oh My God, with our demo. And that changed everything. But we still couldn't get signed. There was a phrase that we lived by because somebody, our manager, who was brilliant, who he came on board after the sort of Single of the Week, I think. And he said... He'd heard somebody say they're too old and they used to be Parva. And that was our thing. We're too old and we used to be Parva. We're only 26 at this point, but he's quite old. And so that really, everything was driving us on to be absolutely massive. We wanted to stick a finger up at every single person in the world. And we did. It was brilliant. In the music industry, not in the world. We'd see people at the Brits 2 years later, all these people had turned us down and we'd just picked up three Brits and we're like, ah. It's brilliant. And that's what drove me. And it was just weird. I was very driven at that point and I never thought it wasn't going to work.
Fascinating to hear that sort of that master plan that you came up with. I guess obviously all those years of hard work and not getting the rewards that you thought you would get initially with that first deal to then come up with that master plan, as I say, to make it work the second time round.
Just be the opposite. That was it. Yeah. I mean, yeah. It was like this. We banned jeans. We banned jeans. We weren't allowed to wear jeans. We had to wear like Farrah's and Stay Pressed, like, I don't know, sort of really granddad trousers and whatever, and jumpers. So one thing was literally, I think our first gig in London, we were like, okay, we've got to wear jumpers. Jumpers? Like, what?
You mentioned the NME there a couple of times, and, you know, I think where we are now, you sort of, you forget how influential it really was and how important it was for bands. And you talk there about, you know, wearing jeans and the look of the band, and that really mattered, didn't it, in terms of, you know, what you looked like if you managed to get into that magazine, in terms of building an audience.
NME was everything, actually. It was the total ticket in. So there's an interesting thing that happened. After our second gig was supporting Franz Ferdinand at the Cockpit in Leeds. We were just like local support because we knew people at the Cockpit, and I was like, we need to support Franz Ferdinand. So we got the gig, and we'd also been doing a club night in Leeds called Pigs. Me and Ricky organised this thing with a guy called Ash, and we DJed and we just put on this night. It was really good. And there was a guy from the NME, Tim Jones, and he used to come and DJ at our club night. And I once told him about the band, and he was like, okay, right. I played in the demo, which he loved. He loved Oh My God demo. I thought it was amazing. And I was like, okay, this is exciting. And then after our second gig, my phone rang, and it was Tim Jones. And he said, what was the gig like? What? Okay, yeah. I just told him, yeah, it was good. It's good. And basically I was doing a review of our gig to him on the phone. And the next week, that was in the NME. And at that point, I was like, okay, they're behind us here. I'm writing my own review. It was unbelievable. It was just a tiny couple of lines and everything, but because it was a Franz Ferdinand review, but there was a couple of lines about us. And I was like, okay, that's our first mention. It was good.
Yeah, the drummer was fantastic.
Yeah, it was just like that. Wow, look at it.
And I suppose it wasn't too long before you were on an infamous NME Awards tour, you know, getting that that high profile gig, sort of the opening slot on your tour. You had a Block Party, the Future Heads, and the Killers headlining. So you'd come quite, you know, I know you'd obviously been working at it throughout the Parva years, but in terms of those intervening years where you were essentially seen as almost damaged goods by record companies, being picked up by Be Unique, NME getting behind you, you all of a sudden had this major slot, and it sort of catapulted you.
Yeah, that was mega. That, I mean, I was scared about even though I really wanted to be the biggest band ever and everything, it was quite scary. So I remember getting that. We were with our manager, and he was like, it looks like you're going to get the NME tour. And we were in a hotel in London, and I was like, it's the end of 2004. This, I was just thinking, if we get that, then we're never going home. And it was, we never went home for about a year and a half after that. And I thought it was really scary, that getting that tour, but we got it and it was amazing. You just got to do these things. That's what I've learned from all this. If somebody gives you an opportunity, the best thing to do is probably say yes and not think about it.
Absolutely. So you got the songs, you got the buzz building up, and so tell us about laying down that debut album, Employment, because obviously now you're a skilled producer now, but how do you look back on it all those years on that process?
Yeah, we'd already done an album at this point, and we knew how to not do it because we didn't even have a deadline. It was really weird. Like, we didn't have a deadline. We just went in every day and just messed about. So this was completely different because we were on tour a lot. I think we just signed to Be Unique, and they wanted to get it. We did a test session with Stephen Street for I Predict a Riot in the bunker in Olympic Studios. And I thought it was amazing because, like, when I first saw him, he's miking up my kick drum, and I'm sitting on the drum stool, and there's Stephen Street on his hands and knees, like, just getting the kick drum, and getting the mic sorted. And I was thinking, this is amazing because he's like the best, and he's working with us, which is great. I couldn't believe it. So we did. We did I Predict a Riot first, which then came out, and then we were like constantly trying to grab time to finish to do the album. We did a little residential thing in Lincoln with Steve Harris. So we did half with Steve Harris and half with Stephen Street. I remember, I think I Predict a Riot had gone into the, so we put out the first version of I Predict a Riot, and we were in Lincoln in this residential studio called the can't remember what it's called, Chapel, maybe? Chapel, yeah. And we were getting our chart position, which is incredible. I think, like, Oh My God had gone in at 66, and that was our demo, going in at 66. It was pretty crazy. Because, you, like, to get 66 now is pretty impossible for an indie band. So we got to 66, we thought that was great. And then our lucky number was 22. Our Parva album had been called 22. When I Predict the Riot came out, we were all in a huddle waiting for the charts, and it came in at 22. 22, like, it was amazing. Like our first proper single. And we all cried because we couldn't believe it, because it had been like a monster journey, 7 years up to that point of every level of rejection. And then we were 22 in the charts. It's incredible.
Yeah. Just pick up a bit more about that song. It's obviously, it's still, it really got into the mainstream then. It's still massively everywhere now, all these years later. So what about the process of actually writing and recording it? Were you aware at the time that this is going to be our big breakthrough?
Yeah, a few things about that. Because I remember we wanted to be weird and obscure and weirdy kind of. So our songs were all kind of influenced by sort of Syd Barrett and Super Fairy Animals. And so there's a lot of weirdness in, like, Oh My God and like the songs I mentioned. And then we had this, I'd written the beginning on the piano, which I used to call the magic piano because I've written lots of good songs on it. And it's my mum and dad's. So I played the verse and I had the verse and I took it into the rehearsal room. We played that. I've got all the recordings, literally. I've got all the recordings of when we first started playing it. Then we didn't have a chorus, so we tried a few different choruses. There's a few different weird ones that I've got recordings of. We tried all that, it didn't work. And then one night in this club that I've mentioned, Pigs, there was a band called Black Wire, and they from Leeds. So they were playing. It was total carnage, and that's what you used to say in those days. And everyone was sort of invading the stage, and the band had taken the clothes off, and people were hanging off these like light fittings and everything. It was really like a bit hectic. It was good fun. The security were all like closing in on the stage, and I said to the owner of the club, "I Predict a Riot," and I thought, "Okay, we'll keep that. I like that," and I wrote it down, and then for the next sort of few days, I think I was trying to get that title to be the chorus of this song. And I have this recording of me, and I can really remember where I was playing this little guitar and in my pajamas and my dressing gown in my flat in Leeds, just trying to get I Predict a Riot to be the chorus. And you can hear all these different versions of it, and none of them are right. And then you sort of really will it when you're listening back, you're willing the real chorus to come out, and it does. Took it into rehearsal. We played it. And Simon, at the end, right, so another thing, in the Kaiserschiefs, the band was so hard to please. Simon, Whitey, Peanut were impossible to, like, get good reactions out of. It had to be so good. That's why our songs had to be, like, better and better and better, because those guys were just so, like, hard to please, really. And when we finished playing it, Simon clapped. I was like, oh my God, clapped. Right, okay. But like I said, it wasn't weird. It was more like a straightforward, you know what I mean? Like Clash kind of this thing. And it wasn't what we were playing. And that worried me, like, is this going to fit? I knew it was good. So I knew we had to get everything else to fit. So we sort of blended towards it a bit.
Nice, Benny. Yeah, as Rich says, it just took off, didn't it? And important record for the important single for the band, of course. And loads of awards followed, didn't they? Enemy Awards, Brits, Ivor Novello, favourites for the Mercury Music Prize. So yeah. How did that feel? Just that, as you say, those 7 years of hard work to get to this point, and then suddenly you start to get some of the rewards for it. It must have been a bit of a whirlwind, wasn't it?
Well, it was a whirlwind. It didn't feel like it does now when I look back at it, and I can see those awards that you just said they're all there. And nice. I love it now, and I love it, and I think back on it and how amazing it was. But at the time, it was literally, we were like the Spice Girls. We were just in everyone's face, laughing and having fun. And none of it, all it meant to us was like a work day, really. Our diary was just full of stuff. So we'd be going, okay, you got a gig in France, gig in Sweden, gig in America, gig in Australia, gig in Japan, NME Awards, gig in Australia, gig. Do you know what I mean? We came back from America for the NME Awards and went straight off to Japan or somewhere anyway. I remember reading in the Mercury Awards, we were on a bus to Amsterdam, I think. And the next morning so we finished the awards, got straight on the band bus, went off to Europe. And then there was stories in the Sun or wherever saying that we'd been partying all night in the Met Bar in London. And we were like, we've been on a bus. So we didn't have time to do any of the partying. Well, we sort of had fun and everything, but we weren't in the Met Bar that night. It just didn't occur to us. We were just having fun. And if you ever see that footage of us at the Brits, it was like completely, like the way that we accepted the awards was just total idiots. Not prepared, not bothered. Now it's all, I'm so humble, grateful for this. We didn't do anything. We just, it was funny.
Yeah, like he says, an absolute whirlwind, you know, to be thrust into sort of that level of fame, you know, so quickly, you know, it must have been extraordinary. And did you, and like you talk about the party and the fun elements to that time, did you have that any moments of reflection to think, do you know what, we have set out to achieve what we intended to here, to, you know, to be that, starting the bandwagon rather than jumping on it?
Yeah. I think the moment I mentioned at the studio where we were in the charts and we all cried, that was probably the last time that happened when we were in the middle of it. Because as soon as the first album's successful, all you think about is the second album. Mm. And then the third album and then the fourth album. And you think about the gigs that you're going to do, and the gigs got bigger, so we've got to work out what we're going to do and what songs and like production and all these things. You just never stop thinking about, you never ever 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 stop, and you're just 100% thinking about the next bit. So, you know, never, and we didn't have Twitter and Instagram, so we were never posting things about, hey, we're so proud, and you know, we were never proud, we were never anything, we were just always working and trying to enjoy it. It was miserable at times, but you know, trying our best to just be good and be the best.
Yeah, well, that work rate paid off, didn't it? Because the second album, the success just kept coming. We'll pick up that on that at the start of part two. But just finally, in part one, Nick, just touch on you playing the Philadelphia leg of Live 8. Yeah, so it was 6 months earlier, perhaps, you were just on that NME tour that we spoke about with the Gillers. And then here you are on this absolutely huge global gig, really, in July 2005.
We used to think that was an admin error. We did, honestly, because it just didn't add up. Because we were at the bottom, the very bottom of the Philadelphia list. We were like, honestly, we thought it was an admin thing. They've put us there by mistake. And so we were, you know, again, we were just like, great, let's do it. I mean, it was amazing. It was a really incredible day. I can really remember it. There was a million people apparently there watching in front of us. Yeah, we played, and I think Will Smith came on after us, and Stevie Wonder, Def Leppard were on. It was mad.
Just crazy when you think about it, isn't it?
Yeah. And we were just doing all this stuff. We were just smiling the whole way. It was great. And now I think, God, like, because after the band, all this stuff, well, even within, when you're in the band, actually, we were just riding this amazing period where everyone wanted to speak to us and offer us stuff, which is brilliant. And now I think back how grateful I am then now for all that, because I've done it. I've done everything that's the dream, isn't it? But things stop, you know, the offers stop coming in. Well, you always get offers, but they're never as exciting as, you know, Philadelphia. And it's never the first time you've done it. So now I think sometimes, especially in lockdown, God, any one of those things that we did in a week would be the highlight of my year. And so you just think, you just look back and be really amazed. And sometimes it's great when I'm working with a young band because I never bring up the subject of like stuff. But I was with this band, like I've been with them a few times, and sometimes I'll ask a little question and the answer like surprises me because it's like, actually, wow, that is pretty exciting.
Yeah, special times, aren't they?
Yeah, dead good.
Oh, we'll hear some more of them in part two.
Hi, I'm Nick Hodgson. I used to be in the Kaiser Chiefs, and you're listening to the Boys in the Band podcast.
Trying to grab all the groceries in one trip? Oof, not how you would have done that. You know sometimes less is more. Like when you drive less and save with the USAA annual mileage discount. USAA, get a quote today.
You're listening to the Boys in the Band podcast. For more noughties nostalgia, check out our Twitter, Facebook and Instagram pages and make sure you hit subscribe to the podcast for more interviews like this.
Welcome back to the Boys in the Band podcast, where we've got Nick Hodgson, formerly of the Kaiser Chiefs, talking us through their story so far. And obviously we've touched on the huge success of the debut, Nick. So how'd you go about following that up 2 years later with yours truly, Angry Mob? What was the approach?
Well, I think we got a bit moodier because, like I said, you know, a lot of opportunities were being thrown at us and we were doing it. And then gradually, I just think it's a natural thing where you get, like, I've talked about this in my podcast as well, where you get a bit, complacent. You take it for granted and you start being moody when you actually should be just enjoying yourself. And that happened definitely to us. And a lot of bands, I know for a fact that a lot of bands, just little things get on your nerves, even though those things shouldn't get on your nerves because you're having a brilliant time and most people aren't doing what you do. And you just, it's just a way that it just occurs, really. So in the second album, we wanted to get a bit moodier. We felt moodier. I remember when we were doing the what to wear and stuff, we wanted to wear, like, we didn't ever think this, but we all wore black on the photo shoot day. It was never a plan. But everyone's wearing black somehow, suddenly. I think we wanted to rebel against being cheeky chappies, which is exactly what we were when we first came out. We were 100% cheeky chappies, but we couldn't accept that we were cheeky chappies because I think it was because other people were telling us what we were and we wanted to tell everyone what we were. And we used to get a lot of sort of bad press and we were, you know, so as soon as you get big, some people still love you, but a lot of it was, you know, we'd get a lot of shit, bad reviews, all that stuff. And we just wanted to, which is stupid because you should just do what you want to do. But we were trying to react to everything that everyone was saying about us and to us, we were trying to react. So we had all these songs and they were a bit harder. Then the label, I think, were like, we need one more single, which is a classic label thing. That's what they always do. And Ruby basically came out. I wrote that on that same piano. And that I sent the demo to a label and they all loved it and everyone loved it. And it was just like a rehearsal room recording. Let me think. I had the verse. I didn't have the words for the verse. Ricky wrote the verse words, but then I had the verse and the chorus. And I said, you know, I sang Ruby, Ruby, Ruby. And I was like, can we actually do that? Can we say those words in a row like that? It's so stupid. Can we do it? We kept playing it, and Whitey played this tough the guitar riff of dun, 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 dun. And we're like, okay, that's better. That makes it tougher. So we're trying to get Ruby, even though it's such a poppy song, to be somehow tougher. So we did that, and that was obviously the one that lifted off. If it wasn't for that, then that album would have sunk. I think it would have had a good first week, but it was. And that surprised me, that Ruby absolutely surprised me. I didn't think it was that good. Couldn't play it that well. The first time we ever played it, ever live, was at the Enemy Awards. And in the front row, the Arctic Monkeys were there and they were looking at us and they were laughing. And I was like, oh dear, what are we doing?
Just picking up on that Arctic Monkeys point, do you feel when you're in rooms like that, do you feel sort of pressure from other bands, or do you feel a bit perhaps self-conscious about what you've done compared to what they've done? because obviously we see you on stage looking all so confident and so proud of what you're doing and so assured of what you're doing. But I guess when you're in amongst those peers, as you say, you're even noticing, oh, what's their reaction to this song? Their reaction to this?
That was the only time I'd had a reaction like that, when I was bothered by something. But it wasn't that I was bothered. I was just like, oh my God, have we chosen the right song here? With those rooms, they were awful. The Enemy Awards was a terrible, horrible, toxic environment to be in. It was awful. We were happy because we were kind of like getting awards, which made it that we didn't have to be as... So everyone on the sidelines was being a real dick all the time, dead moody and like, you know, looking at you funny and everything. But if you were actually getting an award or going up on stage, you didn't feel like you needed to be a dick because you kind of were like, hey, we're getting an award. So you, but I quickly stopped going to the Enemy Awards. I think I went 3 times because I had to. And then I think Ricky kept going. I just couldn't face it. It was horrible. Absolutely, just the room was so unhappy. You know, other things were different, but I only wanted to go to award ceremonies when we got nominated. I'd never go when we weren't, ever. And so it's different when you're nominated, I guess. I would hate to go and I wasn't nominated. I would start being a dick.
Yeah, yeah. Did you still have that same sense that you mentioned earlier about, you know, sticking 2 fingers up at the people around you when you were going up to win these awards?
We didn't even think that at the time. I remember the occasion that happened was just people seeing them at the Brits after, you know, when you're actually holding the awards and you'd see people and they'd say, you know, I did want to sign you. I did try. It was just my boss, blah, blah, blah. Like, yeah, it's fine. Don't worry about it. But at the same time, you're like, yeah. Because you don't say anything, you don't like go, ah, look at this, because then that doesn't really fit with, because it's a funny thing that happens when you actually get the award or you get success, you stop being a dick because you don't need to. I just felt like the being a dick bit is just jealousy and desire to be there at that, to be at the top. But when you're actually those people getting the awards, you feel much more calm and at ease and then you stop getting the awards. That's when people start getting real dicks, when they've had them and then they can't get them anymore.
I can imagine there were lots of sort of record company execs regretting not signing you up earlier when you were selling out the Royal Albert Hall, obviously a huge show. And then after that third album, Off With Their Heads, you played 40,000 at Ellen Road, didn't you?
Yeah.
You talk about these Earl's mega
Court, actually. Earl's Court was the biggest. Yeah, Royal Albert Hall, We did Royal Albert Hall, I think, as a teenage cancer trust, yeah. Mm. But the Earl's Court, we did 2 nights at Earl's Court, which were 18,000 each night. I mean, we sold out straight away instantly. I mean, honestly, that gives me chills now thinking about it. Because I did a solo tour when I put a record out and... I mean, I couldn't sell 18 tickets. I'm not even kidding. It's difficult. So selling that many, it's just amazing. And it's just a wave. It's just being on the right time, right place and all that.
Do these mega shows, do these big shows feel different when you're coming out on stage? Do you feel the pressure?
Don't feel the pressure, but they do feel a bit different and they are amazing. They're the best, I think. They're great. Because you see people that you never see. You see your agent. When we played Earl's Court, the agent was there, Paul, and he had presents for us. Presents. I mean, come on. When that's never happens. It happened once. We got a Wii. He gave us a Wii each. Nintendo Wii.
Yeah.
So you get this mad feeling. You know, your family are there. Do you know what I mean? You know when the good gigs are there, because your family's there and your manager... Your manager's dad's there. They're the best ones. And then you just go, you're off in like, you know, Germany, Italy, Spain, and they're just, you know, great gigs and everything, but they're not the special ones because no one's turned up with presents. So I like the special ones. Ellen Road was good.
Yeah, huge shows, as Pete mentioned. So that was just after the third album, Off With Their Heads, and fourth album, The Future's Medieval, followed. And that was the one, as I read, you recorded partly in your own studio. And this obviously was perhaps the way that you were leaning by that point. Were you more interested in the sort of the creation, the production, rather than the performance, or was there still equal interest in both?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm someone who changes the mind quite quickly. I do change my mind very abruptly as well. So I looked at the third and fourth album were just a bit different to the first two. The first two, I think, go hand in hand. Third one, I think we were just experimenting so much with the music and trying, and we thought it was, I mean, it is good, I think, the third one. And I think the fourth one's got good moments, but we were just experimenting, really, especially with the way we did the fourth one. I mean, I was not interested. By the fourth album, I didn't want to do it. I just wanted to do something else. My dad was really ill. And so I was completely uninterested in the band, even though I was still writing songs. We'd had a bit of time off for the first time ever. And the fourth album, and then Ricky came in with his friend Ollie, and they'd come up with this amazing idea of how to release it. And that was the first time I thought, oh, this is interesting. I did not want to do, here's the songs, here's the album, go on the road. Because I just thought it was uninteresting. And once you've done it so much, you know, being in Australia 3 times at this point and being in Japan 3 or 4 times, you know that once you put the album out, the first thing is the critics. I hated the critic. We're getting less and less good reviews. I felt nervous about putting stuff out. And I didn't want to just put an album out that wasn't received amazingly, because everything, you know, things had changed at this point where, you know, other kinds of music were getting, we were not as popular, basically. And so I wasn't that mad about putting an album out, getting bad reviews, and then buying myself a year and a half on the road. So when Ricky came in with that idea, I was like, yes, I can do this. This is interesting. I loved it. And that really, really sparked everything off. And wrote like 20 odd songs and strangely put them out. It was amazing.
Yeah, so explain that idea. What was it?
We you could build your own album on a website, which is mad. I mean, like, it just seems so weird. I can't remember how much you paid or if you paid or...
I think it was, I saw £7.50 banded around somewhere.
Was it?
Yeah, and you got to hear a minute snippet of each track and then choose your 12 or whatever. So, yeah, really interesting idea.
It was really weird. It cost loads of money. It was really stupid. But it was good. We were on the front of the enemy. Like, they were so shocked that it was the Kaiser Chiefs that were revolutionizing the way that music, because we were like just this regular band at this point. And suddenly we'd done something really weird. And it worked on loads of levels because it got loads of press and everyone was interested. It didn't work in sales. I think it confused a lot of people and people were annoyed. But it worked in other ways. So we needed a few more songs that were like hits as well. But we didn't have them. We didn't have the singles. We just had tons of songs.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think were good. They were good songs. And now I listen back to them now and I think they're really good. I really love them. But there was no singles, which is, you know, it's a disaster for a label.
Nick, you obviously ended up leaving the band at the end of 2012, but before then there was just one more huge show, the Olympics closing ceremony.
Yeah.
We spoke to Frank Turner on this podcast who performed during the opening ceremony, and he had some good stories about sort of the secretive nature of the rehearsals and things like that. So what are your memories? Obviously, you guys played Pinball Wizard by The Who.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I mean, it was just amazing to be there, to be part of it, because it had been at the opening ceremony, if you remember, all people in London were not looking forward to the Olympics at all. They were moaning. Everybody was moaning. And then the opening ceremony occurred. We weren't there. We were abroad, but I remember the instant difference that that happened across London. Everyone I knew in London was suddenly 100 million% into the Olympics. I thought it was brilliant. And so then there was 2 weeks of the Olympics and then we turned up at the end. So it was like, it was such a brilliant, joyous thing. It was amazing. The rehearsals were amazing. Like the Spice Girls were backstage hanging out with David Beckham. It was mega. It was really nerve-wracking, I remember that. And I was really happy when it was finished. And then we just hung out for the rest of the day. It's great. You can see me on that Liam Gallagher documentary in the background with when he's talking to Brian May at the Olympics. And I'm in the background. It was a mad time. I was in a bus on the way back to London. I decided to go home early for some reason. I don't know why. And I just got on this bus because they would like put on for the people who performed and stuff. And on this bus, there was hardly anyone on it, but there was Ed Sheeran and Kate Moss and Harry Styles. And like, I didn't know any of them, so I didn't really say anything. But, and that was it. There was like another five people on it, and those people, it's pretty mad.
So given that level that the band were at that time, you know, the journey you'd been on, was it tough to walk away from, you know, your childhood friends you'd experienced all these amazing things with, or did you feel that you'd done what you wanted to and it was just time for a change, time to move on?
Yeah, I was massively done. Everyone knew I was done. It was, you know, I told them a year before, and that was a weird year because I had a year of touring when, you know, it was all very strange. It didn't feel very good. But I was really happy to be out. It took me months to unwind because it seems weird now, but my stomach was entirely tangled. Being in a band that's, oh man, it was 100% 24 hours a day. You get up in the morning, there was 60 emails, and it was just because, you know, you'd get an email from someone about something, and then there's seven people on that thread. Everyone's got an opinion. Everyone weighs in, and then it's no, yes, no, yes, 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 no. And you wake up, you've got 60 emails, you're like that. And then there's another 60 later on, and it's just a grind. I hated it at the end, and I just wanted to be out. And it took me months to just chill. I went on holiday, just relaxed. It was amazing. And I finally got out of my system. No, it took me about, maybe 6 months to just be back to normal. And it was good. I loved being, I had a haircut, cut my hair off. It was like when you get divorced, it's the divorce. I remember getting my hair cut and my friend was like, oh, you see your divorce cut? That's what you do, apparently. That's what people do. They change their image when they get divorced. Anyway, and there was no real hard feelings, really. I mean, Ricky was a bit weird, but I'm still pals. I've just got messages from him now. I'm on a WhatsApp with him. Let's see what it says. Something about Parva. It's true. So we're still friends. I mean, we can't not be, because once you've been through all that, it's a powerful bond.
Yeah, special, yeah. Obviously, it's given you a chance to go on and release some solo material, as you mentioned earlier. And you've written for a really wide range of artists as well, worked with a really wide range of artists, you know, talking Duran Duran and Coda Line through to James Arthur, Dua Lipa. Yeah, tell us about that sort of new chapter in your sort of musical journey and the different challenges or things you enjoy about doing, working with those sort of varied artists.
That was amazing when I first left the band and I was writing with different people every week and I got a manager. I went on a songwriting camp, which I never knew what that was. I just didn't know what it was. My publisher said, go on this. And it was in France. I spent a week with just total random people who I didn't know, mainly Americans, all professional songwriters and producers. I did not know that you wrote a song in a day. Didn't know. I thought songs took weeks. You shelve them for a bit, you come back to it. I didn't know they had to be about stuff, like specifically with concepts and all this stuff. So I was learning all the time. Like our songs, they were about stuff, but they were also very personal. And so the words were kind of, they drew you in. And like, so I Bring to Write is definitely, okay, this is about this. But Ruby's about the words, really. It's about sounding nice and sounding good and just creating imagery and stuff like that. These songs at this writing camp and everything was like, it was pop. So it wasn't about, it's about high concepts, basically. Okay, like the classic one is, it's just like Unrequited Love. I love you, why don't you love me, sort of thing. I never wrote a song like that ever in my life before that. So I learned a lot. And then I got a manager and I just kept doing sessions and writing with lots of different people. and just learned a totally new skill about how to write different songs. So, I mean, I've got like melodic and I've got melodic skills and structural skills and things like that, but I was learning a different thing, how to write for people not in bands. And I loved it. I thought it was amazing. Just for a bit, I was, you know, every day you were working with someone new, you didn't have to have that pressure of that whole, you know, this is the album, okay, this is your 10 songs, this means everything, because you're going to tour this for the next 2 years. Was not that. It was the opposite. So it was great. I could write a song and just forget about it. And if it came out, great. I was surprised at how few came out, because I'd wrote 100, I think, the next year. And maybe that first year, maybe 3 came out. And then they just learn. I mean, it's fine. I didn't care, really. And then I started to care a bit more, because I was like, okay, this is what I do now. I've got to try and get... but then I've retired twice from it, from songwriting, because it's really depressing as well. Because there's so, I mean, in terms of rejection, I thought I'd experienced a lot of rejection in the band, but there's nothing compared to songwriters' rejection, because you just don't, everyone ignores you. If you write something, you can spend two days on it, then you get 2 days production, and you think it's the best thing you've ever done, it's great, and then you send it, and literally, you don't hear anything. I mean, it does my head in, so I've kind of, I don't do so much of that now. I work with people who I really like. Before, I was just writing with anyone.
Yeah, I suppose that process of actually being working together on something rather than just working on your own and sending it off and seeing who likes it, actually working in partnership with somebody must be a much more fulfilling process.
Yeah, it can be. But there's a real culture now for people relying so heavily on the on their label and their management. And, you know, you say to the artist, do you like it? And they say, I love it. And then they send it to the manager and they don't love it. And then that artist doesn't love it anymore. And I'm like, okay. Yeah, you've got to pick people who are confident, good artists, and also whose management are confident and good and whose label you like. And then you can... So I work with Alfie Templeman sometimes.
Yeah.
He's good because he knows who he is. He's great.
Cool.
And you've got to find these artists unless if you want to be fulfilled and write good songs that people like and come out and, yeah, you got to find the right people.
Yeah. Well, that leads very nicely into our encore, Nick. Last three questions to round things off. And the first question, our encore, is going to be, who would you love to write with that you haven't done so already?
Who would I love to write with? I haven't been thinking in that sort of, especially with COVID, I haven't done much writing with people. So I haven't really been in that mindset. Let's think. If somebody, Harry Styles, 100% Harry Styles, there you go.
Oh, wow.
I'd love to write with Harry Styles. I think we'd get on well.
How come? What do you like about Harry, what he does?
I like that he's a confident artist. Like I said before, he wears crazy clothes. He knows who he is. I don't think he's swayed by everyone else. He writes good songs, and they're, you know, you hear them everywhere, so they're massive, but they're kind of like, because I love the fact that he's got like guitars and drums and instruments and people play them. I also think nowadays it's coming around again, another one of those bandwagon things, that more artists, more of the biggest artists in the world, their production is becoming less like laptop-y, like, and having more instruments.
Yeah, good.
Just a little insight thing I've been thinking about.
Yeah. I think he definitely surprised a few people, didn't he, with his music. It's not quite the one direction candy pop that you might have expected.
Yeah.
More to him than that.
Yeah,
one direction. Second question in the encore, Nick. What was the best gig you guys did as Kaiser Chiefs when you were in the band?
Well, I always would say Ellen Road. That was the most emotional and the biggest, and I'd go Ellen Road. I mean, Glastonbury was amazing the first time we did that. But yeah, Ellen Road.
Yeah. You didn't really touch upon that sort of that connection with Leeds and Leeds United in particular. Yeah. Is that something that really resonated with your fans as well?
Yes. We even started, like when we first started, when we put our first, the demo of Oh My God out, we flyered Elland Road, like we flyered it with his, and I think we connected with Leeds, with the club in some way, and we had some a photo shoot with Lucas Radebe at the training ground, and we had the video was on at half time and stuff. So we just thought that was, we'll connect with that. So then to actually play the ground, and we'd had this mad season as well. We're in League One. I think it was when we were minus 15 points at the beginning of the season. And then we got to the playoff final, which we lost against Doncaster the next day, actually. So we did the gig. Then we got on the bus down and stayed overnight on the bus and went to Wembley in the morning and lost. So we were really, it was an incredible season. And then to top it off with that, it was really good. Amazing. I came out on stage and I had to sing. Obviously, I sang all throughout. And I think for the first song or the first two songs, I couldn't catch, you know, because I was like choked up with emotion. I was every time, it was just amazing. 40,000 people. It felt like from here in 2004, our first gig, to 2008 here in the same city, from maybe 40 people to 40,000 in 4 years, it just overwhelms you, and you never get that sort of, oh, how proud kind of thing. You just acknowledge that this has gone well.
Yeah, that sense of this is huge. Yeah, amazing. Right, last question, Nick, is can you pick out the Kaizer Chiefs song that you're proudest of?
I Predict a Riot.
Yeah.
It really is. It's my favourite song that we've ever done. Technically, I really love it. I think it never stops being interesting. I think all the lyrics are great. It all points to the one topic of what it's about. So I just think there's a load of technical things, like in terms of structure and all this. I think it's brilliant. But I shouldn't say that. Yeah, I mean, I don't mind saying that it's our best song, and you have these, as a songwriter, like me, I've written songs since I was, thank God, like 5 or 6, just writing, making stuff up. And it takes so long to come up with one that can connect with, like, the world. It takes 20 years, and then you try for another 20 years after, and you can't do it. And that shouldn't be a bad thing. A lot of songwriters and composers get upset about that. But just be happy that you did it once, because you've done it. And it's not any... The day before we wrote I Predict a Riot, we didn't have I Predict a Riot. And I don't know, I'm philosophical about this. I love the fact that it connected and it was great. And I still hear it, and still people say, I heard it last night in a bar or whatever. I always say, what did they think? What were people thinking? Were they singing? What were they doing? Were they dancing? Right.
So they always were, always loving it, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Leeds United come out to it. Well, it's the one before. It's on every week. Well, it used to be when we could go in the ground, but actually it still is, because I've heard it on the telly.
Nick, thanks so much for talking us through that Kaizer Chiefs story, and also what you've been doing since then. It's been great to chat.
Thanks for inviting me. Yeah, thank you very much.
Trying to grab all the groceries in one trip? Oof, not how you would have done that. You know, sometimes less is more. Like when you drive less and save with the USAA annual mileage discount. USAA, get a quote today.